Okay, we'll get going with the final talk in this session. So this is a talk from Julie Allenson at the University of York and John Stroop from Princeton University Library. Julie is the Library and Archives IT team leader at the University of York with a particular focus on repository and interface development. And John is repository and discovery application development manager at Princeton University Library and is also heavily involved as a co-editor of the IIIF API specifications. So I'll hand over to them and start with Julie to talk about beyond the institutional repository.
After I've tried to sort that out.
We may need to fix that.
Oh, I see. Just go off
it. Maybe it'll just go back on.
Yeah, it's just gone to sleep, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Thanks, Chris. I'm just going to lower this a little bit because I'm only short. So John and I are going to take it in turns to walk through some slides, but the idea behind this presentation was really to try and recognise that... lots of people, I think, have used Hydra and Fedora for cultural heritage resources, and I think Fedora and Hydra are very well placed to be used for those things. But one of the things we want to talk about in this presentation is that that raises a set of issues and challenges. There hasn't been a kind of coordinated approach to doing that kind of work. Focus in much of the Hydra stack traditionally has been on more traditional institutional repository resources. And I think that's led to certain issues around development being piecemeal, different examples, people duplicating effort. And so we want to walk through some of those issues and give some examples. And we talk about issues and challenges in quite a positive way as well. These are really good examples of cultural heritage sites, but they raise these particular issues. And then at the end, we want to talk a little bit how we think the Hydra stack and the related technologies that are coming on stream at the moment that can actually make this easier and better. So...
So first, I have to apologize. I'm just starting to lose my voice. So if it cracks or... I'm sorry. Okay, so as Julie said, I'm going to address some challenges. Is it just moving very slowly? Is the problem?
I had to click on the next one.
Oh, okay, cool. Sorry about that. So Julie came up with this great... yes, I can. Is that better? Okay, I'll try to stay close too. Julie came up with this great phrase, and I'm sorry that I get to be the one to present it, this notion of magpie collecting. And for those of you who don't know, because we don't have magpies on the eastern half of North America, they're a bird that steals and hoards shiny things. And that's a really great metaphor for sometimes the way our institutions work when it comes to the digital resources that we take on responsibility for. And the result of that is a variety of challenges around modeling, around trying to address different audiences, deal with different preservation and access policies that may vary across collections and across types of resources, dealing with specialized and opinionated viewers, again, based on the types of resources you're working with. Our objects can be quite large relative to those that often wind up in institutional repositories, and that can lead to performance problems. And then finally, we often wind up with quite eclectic workflows. So just to say a little bit more about kind of each of those areas. So I think it's fair to say most of the time when we're talking about cultural heritage material, we're talking about image-based collections and maybe text transcriptions as well. AV is also certainly an area. But I guess the point I kind of want to make in this case is that, you know, at least at Princeton, a digitized book or manuscript averages about 60 gigabytes of content. So that's, I think we say 440 TIFFs or something. So between the images and the metadata and OCR, you know, that's 60 gigs. So it only takes 16 of those to make a terabyte. And if you kind of keep extrapolating, then, you know, at 100 books, you're at 6 terabytes. We don't have 100 books. We have thousands, right? So we're dealing with a much bigger, just, you know, sort of raw file footprint than I think a lot of the Hydra-based IR use cases tend to be. So another challenge that is we deal with these multiple sources of content, again, kind of getting back to the Magpie idea a little bit. One application really never sort of fits all, right? So I like to think of digitization, at least at Princeton, but I think, again, it's a pretty typical pattern, falling into two categories. You have sort of proactive digitization, where you have well-planned projects, and they can be, you know, still be quite small. They can also be quite large, like mass digitization projects. And then you have this notion of reactive digitization, where you're serving patrons, and you may do something very quickly. You may do part of something very quickly, and then want to come back and do the rest of it later. All these different sources can mean you have, again, complicated access controls. You might want to do, as I just said, part of something and then revisit it later, or do a higher quality version of it later. And then, again, because it's a variety of different kinds of content, you often want to apply different sort of preservation strategies to your different resources. And Julie's going to give more specific examples, but I'll just mention one in Princeton's case, which is we have these manuscripts that we digitized in Yemen 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and we know that 80% of them have since been destroyed, right? So even though they're image-based collections, now they're the only copy, and I shouldn't laugh about that. I'm sorry, and it means we really need to, even just within that project, which may look just like our digitization projects of a bunch of old Bibles, which we're still not going to throw away, right? We need to treat those objects very differently. So there's a kind of a specific challenge there. Workflow. Gets tough, again, because of these different sources of content and these different scales and different data models. You're always supporting different workflows that look very differently. And I haven't really even mentioned working with vendors at all, where you might have a sort of quality control step before you even get to the repository or your normal sort of ingest workflow. And then the inverse, of course, is many ways out. We've made a decision that we don't really want to define yet another home for this thing just because we have a digital rendering of it, right? So we prefer to bring the content to where our users are already trying to find things and yet not create yet another sort of silo or place to do that discovery. So our library catalog, thematic collections, exhibits that sort of correspond with physical exhibits. Curators love to embed, you know, images of their latest acquisition in their blogs. Courseware is obvious, and while IIIF is a great way to facilitate all that, IIIF in and of itself is also sort of an important, well, I'm biased, but I think it's an important mechanism for disseminating your content. There's also different notions of what an archival package might look like, right? So we have our local preservation system, but with book and book-like material, we want to export a package for HathiTrust as well. So the sort of canonical state and home of this thing becomes a very fuzzy sort of issue very quickly.
So just to illustrate some of those points with some specific examples. So at York we have something called the York Course Papers. That was a mass digitization project. It produced somewhere in the region of 250,000 images, which when you count the derivatives we store goes up to over a million. This material is archived. They're not books, they're archival documents, but they have a sequence, so there's a book page relationship in there. Public access is provided to this material, but that's done via an external site. That site also hosts the metadata, which has its own bespoke schema. In terms of preservation, This is what I'd call level two preservation. It's a digital surrogate of something we already have, so we want to preserve these surrogates, but we could recreate them if we needed to. Second example from York is our archaeology department slide collection. This is not quite so big. It's a little over 6,000 images. But these aren't, there's no relationship in these. These are single images that are organized into thematic groups, often by archaeological digs, but often in multiple sort of thematic groups where the same thing occurs in different groupings. For this one, we provide public access only via our digital library interface. Coming back to the point John just made on his final slide, we don't really want to have a digital library interface like the one we currently have. What we do at the moment is we present every collection through that interface, which means that people come to it and say, well, what's all this disparate stuff brought together in this single place? It's very difficult to sell what that interface is. So as we move forward, we want to actually split that out into interfaces that are meaningful. The metadata for this all came from a spreadsheet. So again, there was a kind of bespoke workflow had to be created to actually get this material in. In this case, a little bit like, perhaps not as valuable as the Yemen example, but the original slides have been thrown away. So we have the only copy of these images now. So we need, this is what I'd describe as level one preservation. We've really got to look after this stuff. A Princeton example here. So this is a collection of ephemera that's been digitized. There are around 6,000 images at the moment, but this is living, so it's continually been added to. This one has this kind of awkward multi-stage workflow where things go out to a vendor, come back, and during the QA process, the cataloging happens. So again, it's got a bit of a bespoke workflow that's had to be designed just for this project. And then my final one is just around exhibitions. So something we've worked a lot with our History of Art department on at York is building online exhibitions where the images for those exhibitions sit within the digital library and have metadata associated with them there. This is relatively small, it's less than 500 images, but this was quite an interesting one because we've got a bunch of single images of artworks that are just third-part images of other people's content. We don't have to preserve those. But we also digitized the sketchbooks for this artist that were held at the York Art Gallery. So although it's third-party content, it's the only digital surrogate of those sketchbooks. We did it to a very high quality, so really we ought to preserve that, even though it's not ours. So that leads to some interesting questions. It's also interesting because there's a mix of permissions going on in this collection. The York Art Gallery images, we've got the permission to make them public without a downloadable image. But some of the others are actually restricted to York users, and we only have a license for them for 3 years, so there's a process there where we're going to have to either relicense or refactor the interface to take those out at the end of the three-year period. So all of these examples are kind of things we've had to do slightly different things for. So coming on to think about sort of specific efforts to solve these problems, just for York, this is a fairly rough sketch of where we're currently thinking about going with our architecture. I should point out that we're very new to Hydra, so we're only really at the start of developing our Hydra interfaces. But I guess the point I'm trying to make with this slide is that what we want to do is sort of decouple the ingest and consumption interfaces from the layer of services that kind of power those interfaces. Traditionally, we've had lots of things that kind of merge together, those top two layers. So we've got something bespoke for a very particular purpose that when we need something similar but a bit different, we just duplicate the whole code base, and that's really inefficient. So what we're working towards at the moment is providing lots of kind of services that serve out the content and a generic workflow that can actually be flexible for different types of content and content coming from different sources. Just to try and illustrate this with our sort of single cultural heritage example in Hydra, we developed a site. The very first Hydra project we worked on was actually a very, very bespoke cultural heritage example. It's what we call the Archbishop's Registers. This was a one-year Mellon-funded project that we were awarded funding for before we decided to move to Hydra. So just before we started, I said, hang on, we're going to do this in Hydra. Let's learn how to write Ruby on Rails in 10 minutes. So this project was quite hard work, really. But one thing I was really, really keen on in this project is not to just write a standalone application that wasn't thinking about the future of our hydro work at York. So just to illustrate two kind of small examples of what we've done to kind of try and break out some of the functionality. The Archbishop's Registers are kind of like diary entries for the work of the archbishops. So they go around, they went around their diocese and they wrote entries in logs of what they did. That is very rich in people, places, dates and subjects. So just taking people as an example, what we wanted to do is start to build up a really rich authority file for these people and do that in such a way that it would be reusable internally across other similar projects and also externally. And for the external part, we've used the question authority gem, which is really neat because we were very easily able to then expose this authority data for other services to consume. The second example I wanted to just quickly highlight in here is IEEE. So presenting with one of the original authors, I have to say IEEE is brilliant. But it is. I mean, I think, you know, a couple of years ago I'd have been kind of explaining what IEEE was, but now everyone knows it's a kind of given if you want to do anything with images, you do it with IEEE. So in our application, we were able to drive this kind of fairly simple streaming image paging element of the site using IEEE manifests and an IEEE compliant image server. That's kind of really nice. We can also publish those manifests so people can take those away and plug them into other tools. My very small example over here, which I really like because this has really helped me explain to my team why IEEE is really cool, is that when we came to select thumbnails for each of the individual registers, we wanted to highlight a bit on the page where the name of the archbishop appeared, because all the registers are for different archbishops. I did that by going through the image server URLs and basically selecting regions. It's what this sort of thing I do on a Friday night. But I think what is really neat about this is it just really illustrates that we've now got an API against our images, so we can select bits of them, we can turn them around, we can make them different sizes, we can turn them grayscale. I think that's super powerful going forward because it means we can really open up people to access our images and do interesting things with them. Now it's John's turn to take us to the end. I'll see if I can stop that.
So I won't go into quite as many specifics, but just to say to continue the sort of solutioning thread at a slightly higher level of detail, in slightly less detail, we've also tried to sort of solve a lot of these challenges through our architecture. And one challenge we didn't mention earlier, but it just occurred to me we should have, is one of the things we used to do at Princeton a lot is fork metadata. So when something gets digitized, somebody would run like an XSL. I don't know what they did, but they made mods records from MARC records, and then did a bunch of value-added work on that, and it would never. That work would never find its way back to the catalog, and if the catalog record got better, it would go never find its way back to the mods. Forever, you had these two descriptions. So we have this notion of data providers in our architecture, and that includes both the people who are providing us with images and you know files, but also all of our existing sources of data. So we only create new data as a last resort. Instead, we've built an API to our catalog, a read-only API to our catalog, and also to our finding aids applications, so that in Plum, which is our Hydra implementation, you can reference those records, and you do snapshot a copy, but there's a variety of mechanisms for refreshing that data at will. So the only data that really gets created in Plum is data that's unique to the digital rendering of this thing, and that includes, like, you know, maybe you only did one volume of several volumes, so you might add like a note saying this is just part. And then, of course, structural metadata, labels for the images, ordering, that kind of thing. What happens from there in Plum? So the public never sees Plum. Its workflow only, and it's really just orchestrating these other tools and workflows. So workers in Plum will make, in the case of images, JPEG 2000 images that sit on our image servers, geospatial material. They render some other derivatives that go on those servers, those applications. And then between the media servers and IIIF coming from Plum, along with messaging that lives here, we have a variety of applications that can stay in sync with our repository by just responding to messages and then using IIIF and IIIF's references to the more semantic metadata to stay in sync and do whatever you want. Plum would also then facilitate like the embedding use case and so on. So by keeping these concerns you know, as separate as we sort of can, and running it on lots of distributed hardware, we're starting to deal with the scalability problems. Now, you've been in other sessions where you've heard about some performance issues with Fedora, and we're working on those as well. But I think it's going to be better for us in the long term, because these more bespoke projects become easier wherever they can become easier, and we can focus on the parts that really are unique to the materials. I also want to give a shout out to the Hydra Architecture Working Group, because we've worked through a lot of these things together. We know that these are problems that maybe some of the bigger cultural heritage implementations of Hydra have found first, but they're not going to be the only ones. Everybody's repository is going to grow over time. Hydra doesn't do a lot with big data that I know about anyway right now. So the problem, these are challenges everyone's going to run into eventually, and I don't think they're unique to us by any stretch. So watch this space, and we'd love to talk more, I think, about these sorts of challenges and interesting ways we can work together to solve them. And that's it. Thanks. I can tell you it is a challenge for Princeton, and it's something that's on our roadmap, but we haven't thought about it a lot in terms of how it would be implemented. We know some use cases. The challenge for us is like 80, I'm guessing 75% of our born digital material is dark. So in some ways that makes it easier, like just trust us. I think the thing that I've been least sure about is how much of their workflow do we want to build into Plum or into Hydra, right? They've got great tooling with the FRED. I can't think of the operating system. They've got a whole really great workflow, and how much do we want to facilitate that versus just take this package they feel very comfortable with and back it up and figure out the appropriate way to index it and give some sort of virtual rendering of that. That's about as far as the thinking has gotten for us. I don't know if you have anything to...
So,
make sure you...
Thank you. Obviously, the other presentation I did first thing was about the work we've done with Archive Massacre research data. So I think what we are hoping to do is, so we use ATOM, which is the Artifactual Systems Archival Cataloging tool. So a piece of work we want to do is look at how Hydra manages the dissemination copy of the data, Archive Massacre manages the archival copy of the data, and ATOM is the view. The idea I have for this is that if we could embed some kind of maybe JavaScript viewer into ATOM, we could say, oh, we have this in Hydra, and it just present it through the ATOM interface. I think that's my idea. But it's definitely an area we're working with our digital archivists on and thinking about. We just don't have a solution yet.
Other questions?
Oh, yes, sir.
So I'm wondering if, you know, we've talked in several different sessions at this meeting about PCDM, about possibly extending PCDM, getting a bit more specific. And I know that, you know, the motivation for keeping it very simple was that we wanted sort of least common denominator that could be a bridge across different projects and so forth. But do you think that there's a space for extending PCDM in some way to deal with these different content types that you're talking about in the cultural heritage sphere?
Do I take it?
I can give my, I'll give my sort of view on that. I think when we modelled the data for the Archbishop's Registers, we did base it around PCDM. So I think you can, if PCDM is to remain a fairly generic data model, you can model certainly the work part, the work collection part of cultural heritage resources with PCDM. Whether PCDM should extend to things like real-world objects, authority files, I'm not quite sure, but I think it's important to try and apply the generic PCDM model whenever you're doing any kind of project work, and then sort of model the specifics to your own local requirements, and then sort of push those models back out as examples to the PCDM community. So there is a lot of people grappling with this at the moment. How do you model different types of collections with PCDM? So I think the value at the moment is just to keep sharing individual work, and that's what we're trying to do.
PCDM is so low level. I can't imagine an area where you need to extend it exactly so much as be opinionated about it in the way you use it. And in some ways, that's already the case, right? In HydroWorks, there are file sets, right? File sets are not a PCDM construction, right? That's practically speaking, there's rarely one version of a file. And I don't mean versioning over time. I mean, like, if you have an image, you probably have a thumbnail, right? So that notion already is kind of an opinionated layer over PCDM. There are some other things we've done in Plum, which so far Plum is about books, that we think we did a really good job, frankly, modeling books and book use cases, and we intend to extract that out into a separate plugin called Book Concerns. There's kind of a stub for it already in, I think, Project Hydro Labs. There are some things that it would be easier to do if we had them in PCDM, and ranges are the thing that come to mind for modeling structural metadata. And whether those are formally PCDM extensions or they're just assumptions around a best practice on how to do that kind of thing. You know, PCDM was always kind of born out of sort of shared best practices. And I'd like to see it continue that way, personally.
Yeah, I guess if I could just extend on what, you know, I don't think we want to get rid of that common core portion of PCDM, but if we're going to be opinionated, then shouldn't we be opinionated in the same way?
Right? I guess
newspapers, should we all have, you know?
I think we're saying the same thing. I agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, if somebody had done other PCDM book work around a workflow tool and all that, and maybe we hadn't, just didn't realize it at the time, that would certainly make sense. And I agree with you. I'd like to see PCDM go in that direction. And early on, there was some work, I think still somewhere hung off of the PCDM wiki or somewhere, there's about a half a dozen sort of idealistic models. I think there's a book. I think there's a couple different geospatial ones. I think there's a really simple postcard. There's five or six things. Do you know them, Christina? You're nodding like maybe you do.
Yeah, no, we're trying to keep
them. Okay. But anyway, there's a variety of sort of Google drawing graphs that sort of represented how we thought you might do this in PCDM early on. I'd be interested to see how much of those reflect actual implementations that have happened since then. But it's always been an idea, I think it's fair to say.
Okay, so we've come to the end of the time now. Thank you very much again to the authors.